Next talk is about opportunities for reducing greenhouse gas emission from Canadian croplands by Dr. McConkie.
Thank you and good morning.
Yeah, so our issue is we are, of course, Canada does report its soil organic carbon changes on its land based on changes in tillage system, changes in summer fallow or a year without vegetation, changes between annual and perennial crops, and of course land use change, but we don't really explicitly include the effect of changes in carbon inputs and soil organic carbon. So we've been looking at this for some time and asking ourselves how important is this into soil organic carbon balance. And just for those that aren't so familiar with Canada, it's only about 7% of the land area can be or really is used for agriculture, and it's actually discontinuous in small pieces. And so you'll see this in maps coming up, and just so that you're sort of aware that it's only a small portion of the country that's that we're really talking about here in terms of soil organic carbon change. So in terms of carbon input, basically, not unlike many other countries, of course, yields have been steadily increasing. So looking from 71 to 2015, so that's roughly 45-year period, we can see that pretty well every crop has had important increases in carbon, particularly maize. The only exception is our hay crops, which are primarily alfalfa grass mixtures. But also the area of the crops have been changing quite dramatically, particularly canola. And you can see that, you know, it's gone up by 8 million hectares over this period of time. Other crops have decreased. Legume crops have also increased quite a bit. But the biggest, and also a huge drop in this area of bare summer fallow. So how do we estimate carbon input? So it's really from the estimating the residue from the crop area and yield, and also considering the removal of residue that's required for livestock. Then we estimate the below ground residue carbon from 0 to 20 centimeters, and considering the root distribution, soil depth for different crops. And then, of course, we have to make an assumption about rhizodeposition, and we assume 50% of the root biomass carbon. We also looked at the manure carbon input based on livestock numbers, volatile salt extraction. Of course, it is now some of that residue that's been removed from the crop side now comes back in or comes back applied onto the soil through the manure. And again, particularly on the manure side, really a lot of the work isn't done for us in a sense in terms of our National Greenhouse Gas Inventory Report, of course, calculates all this manure carbon based on the, you know, number of animals, types of animals, size of animals, diets, and manure handling systems, storage systems. So the big picture here is really in this corner where really in terms of Canada, at least our input to agricultural land has increased, almost doubled in that 45-year period. So quite a dramatic effect. Then you can see here the effect of different individual crops. And the really interesting one here, of course, is canola, because it's, again, it had somewhat increasing yields, particularly more recently, but huge increase in area. And as I'll show, it has a much higher amount of carbon input than other crops. And so it's actually kind of overwhelming Canada's input of carbon into agricultural soils. And this is sort of interesting because Keith Plasteen et al., in terms of the concept of climate smart soil, said, well, we really need some sort of a crop that has enhanced root phenotypes. That's a real important way that if we were going to achieve mitigation. And that just by happenstance, I guess we have that in this crop of canola. So this just gives some example grown under the same general conditions comparing wheat and canola. And so many people wouldn't think canola has a lot of carbon input because its yields are relatively small, grain yields are relatively small. And also, when you look at the soil after a canola harvest, because of the harvesting operation tends to pulverize a lot of the residue, it doesn't look like a lot of residue, especially compared to a cereal crop. So everyone always thinks, well, cereal crops, those are the ones that are really producing the carbon input. But as shown in this case, where they're has grown under the similar conditions. In fact, the canola input was almost 1.5 times that of this major cereal for Canada, wheat. So this is really that, and a lot of that, as you can see, is from the roots. So it really is a unique crop in that regard and has an important, then, as I showed, important impact on carbon input. We use the Roth C model, fairly well-used model, and it actually seems to work best for us for, above all, carbon models for Canadian conditions, especially for this particular application where we're really focused on the carbon input. So we can estimate the carbon inputs outside of the model as opposed to more ecosystem models such as Century or DNDC that would actually be simulating the crop yields. In this case, we can actually input them directly, and then we use the carbon that we have in our national soil database to in 1971, and that's roughly what that data is considered to be relevant for. And then we did, of course, do quite a bit of validation to show some examples, and it tended to work very well, actually, without a lot of calibration, and also worked very well across a range of sites. So we're quite comfortable in some ways with Roth C, although there are still issues to deal with. So now this is kind of a pulling together the results of that. So what has been the annual SOC change rate, just really based on carbon input changes? You can see that it's actually quite large. This is kilograms per hectare per year. So it can get up as high as 300 kilograms per hectare per year. You can see most of the western part of the country, where most of the agricultural land is by and large a large increase in soil carbon, or a big sink. Then there are areas in the east part of Canada which have a much smaller area actually of agriculture that are quite strong sources, but there's also sinks as well. So that's and this is just really from the carbon input, and also has to, of course, the effect of the initial carbon also has an effect. So the ones that are losing carbon are the soils that have the highest initial carbon amount, just from the soils database. One of the questions we had was, it was a lot of people haven't really been looking at carbon input from manures, especially in these sort of studies, and we were really asking our question, how important is that? The livestock numbers in Canada are relatively, well, they're generally increasing, I guess, across particularly pigs and poultry, but the amount of manure there on the bottom, as you see, has not been changing all that much. Again, there's changes as well in manure storage, just to handling systems and losses of carbon and so forth. They're also embedded in that manure estimate. So we asked ourselves, okay, well, just say, let's take out the manure. So it's really hypothetical, obviously. We haven't changed the farming system still, but we just said if we took out the manure, how much difference would it make? And we can see that actually, and this shouldn't be surprising to anyone in soil science, that it can have locally huge impact. So areas with lots of manure, especially areas where have increased manure in that 71 to 2015 period, can show very large increases simply from that manure, even though the manure itself in a 2015 context is less than 10% of the carbon input, but obviously the quality and nature of that carbon is very different and very beneficial to increasing soil carbon. So it was very important to include manure in the estimate. What about tillage? Right now in Canada, of course, no-till is now the predominant tillage system, and the opportunity to increase no-till is probably hit sort of the areas that are most suitable for it have already changed over. There's probably still some opportunity to convert from the full to reduce tillage in terms of reduction in tillage, but obviously there are, at least in the Canadian context, and we have lots of empirical evidence to support this, obviously, that reduced tillage, no-till, particularly in the western part of the country where plows aren't used, or moldboard plows aren't used, we get reduction tillage. So this isn't captured really by Roth C model. So we went to our existing systems, which we actually use Century, and made a factor for reduced tillage, the difference between with and without tillage system change. So these would be the numbers that we get from that century-based thing. We can see that it's very, very small. If you remember, the carbon input changes would be almost an order of magnitude higher. So really, although there is important sinks, especially in this area, this is where pretty well no-till is predominant, and where there's no moorboard plowing, and that's really where there is some certainly significant increase in carbon, although it's quite small, really relative to what we were estimating now with from the carbon input change. So this is the results then, pulling the numbers, summing, aggregating the numbers across the whole country. And of course, we get a lot of interannual variability, and that's just because, any year where yields tend to, be a bit higher, of course, carbon tends to increase, and then if yields decrease, the model is very responsive to that, and you see this up and down, a lot of interannual variability. So we can easily smooth that out with a five-year moving window, and now we just added essentially the tillage effect from those factors onto the carbon input. So just assuming that there's no interaction there, but we can just simply sum them. And you can see though that the tillage effect is really, at least in this modeling situation, is really relatively small and relatively and not that important compared to carbon input differences. So how does this compare to what we have been reporting? And so I've put that down in that smooth line. Of course, it's very smooth because our factors are designed intentionally to remove any interannual variability. We can see it's not so much different, I guess, in the general magnitude or direction, but you can see quite a difference, especially in more recent years. The carbon input side is causing, or at least we're estimating, as large increases due to that, and that would be consistent with that's been the period of the most rapid input change in carbon inputs. Whereas if we look at just changes that are driven from tillage and changes in fallow and things, that in fact we were predicting we'd actually hit sort of peak sink, and we're actually starting to go down. So really quite a different story. So for Canada, under the Paris Agreement, our nationally determined contribution is for 2030 relative to 2005. So 2005 is our base year. So everything 2005 becomes a very critical year then. So we continue just everything on trend. So area and yield changes on trend, and then just looked and see, okay, where would then we estimate our carbon change across the country. So of course it smooths out obviously because there's no more interannual variability. Is essentially just sort of an average based on the 2005 to 15 trend. But the important thing is that especially relative to 2005, this is actually quite a large number for Canada, because it's essentially we'd be in CO2 equivalents equal to the amount of either total methane emissions from agriculture or total N2O emissions from agriculture. So this is very obviously very significant in terms of essentially acknowledging the importance of what farmers have done in terms of increasing yields and changing crop types and diversifying and whatever, and they've achieved this large increase in carbon input. And essentially, we haven't been reporting it. It has a very important effect in sort of how agriculture will be perceived by the rest of society as well. So just briefly, I'll just talk about a few other opportunities. One of course, is continual plant cover, or especially cover crops. What's the potential, particularly for cover crops? I think the climate, the very continental climate. So essentially, you tend to grow the crop during all the time when you have a combination of warmth and water. And so trying to have anything outside of that in terms of like a cover crop, it's very difficult to have any significant production. Green manure, where you actually replace a commercial crop and use that warm, wet period, you could grow a commercial crop and grow a green manure crop. Obviously, you could put a lot of carbon in, but obviously that's extremely costly from the farmer's perspective because there's no income. So certainly, among all our situations, our greatest opportunity would be in sort of the most southern part of Canada, where we have combination, where we have the most warmth and water. And within that would be following winter wheat, since that's coming off early. So we'd have a considerable period of time after winter wheat harvest, when there'd be both warmth and water to grow a cover crop. So we ran that scenario. Now, there isn't a lot of winter wheat. It's not that economically attractive. And so there is a line there that actually adds the cover crop, and you can't see it because the effect is so small. But it also shows how, I mean, the overwhelming thing that's changing is that it's predicted to be a source throughout this area, this mixed wood plain ecozone, and that's becoming a decreasing source, and that's being driven really by all the changes in carbon. So especially maize yield increases and things are sort of overwhelming, and so the small effect we can have with the cover crop is lost and amounts to only a few, less than sort of a percent of the total carbon change. What about residue harvest for biofuel? I mean, we did a study. This was just pulling all the empirical data, just saying that. Definitely saw some quite concerning numbers, I guess, that we could lose almost a megagram of actual carbon for a megagram of crop residue. So, and in the first 10 years, so quite a concern. So, as now I said, we are including the crop residue removed for livestock purposes, but not considering there isn't still at this point in time in Canada a large amount of harvest for other purposes of biofuels or bioproducts. But if that increases, obviously we would have to include that in our estimates of carbon input and include that into our modeling. And of course, there's always this interest in, I guess, in biochar. There's certainly another opportunity to put some probably quite long-lived, relatively stable carbon, and the potential limit there, of course, is just how much biomass do we have. We don't really have, there's not really strong indication that there's really any real benefit for Canadian soils to have biochar, and so we certainly also need that a very careful life cycle assessment, particularly if we're using it for energy production. So to summarize then, capturing these carbon inputs is really important, obviously from the point of view of accuracy and reporting on the mitigation that farmers are achieving within Canada. And this is also extremely important under the Paris Agreement for Canada, because a lot of that sink kind of comes from 2005, whereas if we don't include, as we're not doing now, carbon input effects, then in fact we become a net source from CO2 or declining sink, I guess would be the other way of looking at it. So also they're much more important than reducing tillage, and also we don't really have a lot of opportunity probably to increase carbon from reducing tillage. Crop type is extremely important here, so I think this, thinking about it from a rotational point of view, and particularly in Canada, canola production is really driving a huge amount of the increased carbon input in SOC change. Livestock manure is a small carbon input, but locally important. Cover crops, at least in the Canadian situation, look like they're not going to really have much potential to really increase soil organic carbon overall, but obviously there are, very situation-specific benefits for horticulture systems or whatever. So it's not saying cover crops shouldn't be done, but they're not going to be our answer to soil carbon. And in terms of things like biochar, obviously we need much more work to decide how to go forward with that. And thank you.
We only have time for one quick question.
Mandatory to include green legumes on the rotations. And I wonder which is your opinion, or you have been working on the effect of the inclusion of those green legumes in soil organic carbon stocks under your conditions.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like it's either a negative or a positive compared to other crops. So even though the carbon input is perhaps maybe lower than many other crops, there doesn't seem to be in these empirical evidence, it's basically been as you know, the crop itself is, there's been no sort of indication of kind of a loss of carbon from having it, and obviously huge reductions in emissions associated with nitrogen fertilizer production. So it's overall net, clearly a net benefit to have a lot of green, and they're very much increasing in Canada all the time, a lot of green legume crops.
Okay. Thank you so much.